I welcome to the air Mr. Norm Farrell. Good evening, Norm.
Hi, Glenn. It's good to be with you tonight.
Oh, it's good to have you, sir. Thank you for joining us. Now,
great.
You know, I've been made aware of your work and what you've been pursuing probably in the last 6 or 8 months, I've really noticed. But you're not really a newcomer to this game, are you? I mean, 2009, you've been at this for a while. For people who don't know who you are, give us a little background, please.
Well, I'm a retired small business accountant. I spent many years working in the service sector of the motion picture film industry in Vancouver. So we used to, our work covered most of Western Canada. We provided film laboratory services and so on. And I'm actually quite proud still today to have helped build the foundation of what's now a major segment of the economy in Western Canada. And I've been retired for a number of years now, but I have had an interest in writing and have pursued that and started blogging back in 2009, just with the intent of doing it for a short while to improve my skills at writing. That I had taken a few courses here and there, and I'd written a lot of business material in early days, but I wanted to do something that was a little more creative, and I thought that commenting on political affairs in North America was going to be of interest. And so I started something called Northern Insights, and stuck with that name for quite a while, and then dropped Northern recently when it became obvious that my focus was almost completely on the West. When I started back in 2009, I had an idea of taking a view of what was going on in the U.S. and in the whole of Canada and so on. But ultimately, my focus became on British Columbia, simply because it was close to home. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized it needed attention, and that the mainstream corporate media was simply failing to do the job that they should be doing. Today, I really admire some of the old names of journalism in British Columbia, people like Jack Webster, who I listened to diligently in earlier days. Rafe Mayer is another individual. He was on radio,
yes,
and has done a lot of writing as well. Still, he's active today, even though he's in his mid-80s. Rafe has actually been a bit of a mentor to me, and I've had the great luck to converse with him on occasion and to even visit with him. And he's an individual who I think has a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge, having been a cabinet minister himself, been a lawyer, and he's really has had his pulse on what's going on in British Columbia for a long time. And he has no sacred cows, so he's willing to speak to any kind of issue without regard for whose feelings it might hurt. And I've tried to be a little bit like Rafe. I'm kind of like a minor league Rafe Mayer, in my own mind at least, if not in other people's minds. And later on this evening, I'm going to be reading some material that Rafe sent me earlier this afternoon. And we exchange views and ideas. And again, I see him as somebody who I wish had more visibility in the mainstream, because whatever he says is still very intelligent and very on topic.
Oh, I agree with that. I did approach Rafe to do a show. As you mentioned, he's not a young man anymore. And he determined it'd be a little too much for him to do of a full show. And I respect that, but I certainly do follow his work. There's no doubt about it. I guess we could mention Ian Jessup for a newer generation, but as we've seen lately, things haven't been the easiest road for Ian either, but I'm sure he'll be back at some point.
Yeah, I think it's an example, though, of how the corporate media has a different purpose than what we were taught that it should have. we used to think that the corporate media, particularly the political pundits, were there to hold the feet to the fire and to act in the public interest, to examine the issues of the day, take advantage of their positions of knowledge and access to really be able to speak truth. Instead, we've converted into a system whereby government has worked very hard to, tame the herd of people that work in political reporting. And so these people have grown used to having pre-digested material submitted to them so that they, if government wants an issue raised to the public, they just have to slip it to one of their friends in the press, and out it goes. So an example of that, Glenn, was I came across an article in the Vancouver Sun recently. It made reference to a few companies being given $100 and some million by way of what they called infrastructure credits in the gas industry. And if you were to read that article, you would have imagined that that was just one simple program that was aimed at improving the employment prospects of the people that are now currently unemployed in the gas fields of Northeast BC. But I knew better, because they've had these infrastructure credits ongoing for many years, I think actually dating back to about 2004. But it's really only in recent years that they've started to just wipe out the public revenues from natural gas. So that while the Sun was reporting that in the next year, $100 million would go to these particular companies, I knew that in the last 2 years, $1.9 billion has gone to all of the gas producers. And that is by deducting, these are what we call tax expenditures. They're not cash payments made by government, but they're credits that the companies can use to in lieu of making cash payments. So that if you had a credit like the gas companies had, instead of paying your income tax whenever somebody submits a check to you or you file your tax return at the end of the year, you would simply give them, apply the credit. Now, government would be out the money because it doesn't have any revenue, but they don't have to call it an expenditure because you didn't actually exchange checks. You simply deducted from what you otherwise owed the government. So anyways, the gas industry in fiscal 2015 and fiscal year 2016 have taken deductions of $1.2 billion, but they've earned additional credits, which they haven't yet been paid, and as a matter of fact, the government hasn't even bothered to record, but we know from the Auditor General that the total owing grew from $1.2 to $1.9 billion in the last 2 years. So on top of the $1.2 billion they deducted, there's another $700 million that's gone to their credit. So that's almost $2 billion. And I challenge any listener of yours to go onto the mainstream media and find anything that explains that information. That's almost $2 billion worth of tax expenditure that simply does not get recorded anywhere in the media. And if we think of many of us in BC kind of ironically make reference to the fast ferries, and so we can count the value of anything in terms of how many fast ferries that involves, because the fast ferries of the old NDP days turned out to be costing close to, well, over $100 million each. They built three of them, and so for every $100 million or so, you can say that's a fast ferry. Well, when it comes to the gas the gas scandal, or what I think should be a scandal, in terms of these hidden tax subsidies, that's almost 20 fast ferries. Fast ferries were, of course, a huge issue that were in daily play in the newspapers in those days. So it all depends on whose ox is being gored, that whether it's of interest to the corporate media or not.
So I imagine the other side of the coin, if this issue ever comes up, these tax expenditures, these credits, are going to, global multinationals, I'm sure for the most part, Patronus among others. And it is under the premise that they are creating jobs and industry and other things that, according to what the politicians would have us believe, is a sustainable industry that's going to contribute to British Columbia for decades. Is that the story that they give?
Well, I'm certain that you could find a ready argument from many people that anything related to fossil fuels is not a sustainable activity. But, the theory was back in the day that there were certain kinds of work that gas exploration companies wouldn't do if it were too difficult. It's what they called marginal properties or deep yes. drilling and so on. And so the idea was that the government would offer these tax credits to encourage gas companies to do work that they otherwise would not have done. And that would lead to greater production and more employment in the business. But the fact is that it became something that industry began to rely on. Industry, on one hand, will tell investors that we have among the lowest cost gas wells anywhere in the world in northeastern British Columbia. And yet they're demanding of government more and more in the way of subsidy. I've also been told that a few years ago, when the government each month puts out various properties to bid for petroleum and natural gas rights. And a few years ago, the gas companies were falling over each other, competing to get these spots locked up for exploration rights. And they got really enthusiastic and actually spent billions of dollars over the course of just, I think, 3 years. There was well more than $5 billion paid for drilling rights and permits and so on attached to the exploration. Then the market turned and the gas producers said, hey, we've committed ourselves to pay all these huge sums of money to explore, but now the gas marketplace isn't as profitable as we expected, so we need to find a way of reducing our costs and increasing our profits. I'm told by people not officially that the gas credits were a system of creating an informal rebate to the gas companies, that the government recognized that they had paid all this money and that they were having relatively tough times with lower gas prices. So the government didn't want to come out and say, hey, all of those people that participated in a free market bidding process, we're now going to refund a bunch of that money, because that would look kind of ridiculous. So they wanted to find a way of feeding back money to the industry without taking any political heat. And therefore, they started to elevate or escalate the amounts of money being awarded through these tax credits or infrastructure credits. They make announcements every now and again, as they did with the $100 million or so that I referred to the Vancouver Sun reporting on. They'll make announcements periodically about some small segment of the entire program. That one that I referenced in the Vancouver Sun is under 1% of the total. But yes. Anyways, it's hard to understand what truly goes on, because government. I find that most of the material that's published by government is just public relations, and I have to plow through perhaps 400 pages to find one page of worthwhile material. And everything that I report, I want to be based on fact. I express opinion in a lot of the bases a lot of times, but I want people to recognize that the opinions I express are based on factual information that they can go out and find themselves. But I do get people who will whisper in my ear or tell me stories, and Some of them I don't bother to write about because I can't confirm them, but others, they make so much sense with when I examine the circumstances that I can't resist discussing them. And this idea about government making a conscious decision to return funds to the gas industry is one that was told to me. And it just seems to fit the fact circumstances so much that despite the fact that I haven't had it really solidly confirmed, I believe it to be true.
No.
So,
something else.
Anybody? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, something I was curious about is these producers, these exploration companies who are getting these credits. Is there any connection between them and donations to, say, the BC Liberals?
Oh, absolutely. One of the largest segments contributing to the Liberal Party in BC is the natural resource sector. And it's not just the millions of dollars that they've fed to the party directly, but they create organizations that are supposedly industry or citizen related organizations, but they're really nothing more than shills for government or for the companies that set them up. I'm thinking of a company like, or an organization called Resource Works that spends a huge sum of money trying to convince people that natural resources are huge contributors to the provincial economy. They, of course, never give any of the kinds of numbers that I give, which is the actual dollars flowing through directly from the industry to government, or the payments that are being made for the harvesting of public resources. What they'll do is they'll look at individuals who are directly and indirectly employed, and then they'll count all of the tax contributions so that, you know, if your nephew worked in the gas business, they might count the property taxes that you pay on your house as part of the contributions because your nephew works in the gas industry, right? They really are pretty careless in terms of setting together what these alleged benefits are. Now, I'm not a person who says we should never touch the natural resources, that we should leave them in the ground. But I think it's important to recognize that there's great values being produced, and the public, which owns those resources, ought to get a fair share of their value. In addition to extracting a fair share of the public value, I think it is extremely important that the public ensure that the resources are harvested in the most sensitive fashions possible. That if you look in British Columbia, we've had this tendency, which was, of course, exacerbated by the attitudes of the federal Harper government. The attitude is that any kind of regulation or supervision by government is simply a question of red tape that interferes with business. Now, if I want to build an addition to my house, I have to go to the municipal hall and I have to get permits and all of that kind of thing. And then I'm going to be inspected by various people, experts, and I have to hire additional experts. But it's all done to the oversight of the people in the building department. And the aim is to ensure that whatever gets built is not going to fall down and kill somebody in the next year or cause damage to the property and so on. Business ought to be subject to the same kinds of rules that we impose on individual citizens. There was an example where the Mount Polly mine, which was owned by Imperial Metals, which is controlled by Murray Edwards, who was formerly a resident of Calgary, a billionaire who's got activities all over the place, from the tar sands to the interior of British Columbia to various kinds of things.
To the Calgary Flames.
Absolutely. Murray Edwards and various of his associates have contributed millions of dollars to the BC Liberal Party. He specifically has done fundraising in Calgary to raise money on behalf of the provincial government. And when his company, Mount Polly, had a disastrous breakage in a tailings pond dam that flooded and poisoned various important waterways in British Columbia, streams that people's lives depended upon, there was ultimately no penalty paid.
Yep.
Directly. There were no charges laid. The government, basically gave these people a free pass and just said, please don't do it again. And yet at the same time, there was somebody not too far from where I live, a citizen that was doing some fill in his yard, and some of that fill slipped down the slope, and they hauled him into court. They had gave him numerous charges against him, such that had he been convicted on all of these charges, that he would have been paying hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines. He ultimately did get a really significant fine, and they, in addition to the fine, which I'm not saying it wasn't deserved, but he also had to pay a huge legal costs and reparation costs and so on. So there's an example of an individual being punished by the full extent of the law, whereas the corporation that has been stuffing millions of dollars into the pockets of the politicians, they skated away for something that was perhaps a million times more serious, a billion times more serious. And that, unfortunately, I think, is what happens when you allow big financial interests to take over and control political parties. You in Alberta have already addressed that situation and don't allow large companies and unions and so on to maintain financial control over political parties directly.
Well, we've done better than most, but don't let appearances fool you. It's not like things are a whole different world over here. There is a party in Alberta in the legislature, the official opposition, that is controlled by one group. They are not officially corporate, but they are also one of the biggest corporate conglomerates on the face of the earth. But because they tend to congregate on Sundays and refer to a certain book, they get away with not being called a corporation. But that's another issue. But the information that we're going off is basically off one of the posts on your site called News or Not News. Is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
Okay, now I'm looking that over, and I'm looking at the list of corporations here that have contributed to the BC Liberals, and it's a who's who. In the natural gas and mining sectors, we have Anadarko Canada Corp., we have CNRL, we have Ensign Drilling, Ensign Opsco, Ensign Rockwell, Horizon Construction Management, who I believe was part of the Portman debacle at one point, Huckleberry Mines, Imperial Metals, Mount Polly, Penwest Petroleum. You know, these are the guys who are going to be doing the big damage when
they
come.
They're all involved with Murray Edwards. He's associated with all those different organizations. And I was trying to indicate as well how ineffective our reporting system is, because if somebody wants to push money over to the political party, they can do it directly, but they can also do it through a number of other fashions. We've seen it happening in Canadian politics, where the individuals will ask, or one individual will ask another group of individuals to each contribute sums of money, and then they'll reimburse them. In public, there's no connection. They'll use subsidiary companies so that not everything that that Murray Edwards directs to the BC Liberal Party comes with a label attached to that one individual. Money may flow through not only just through the companies that he directly controls, but companies that he has asked to make some contributions and so on. So we really can't even get a comprehensive list of how much any one particular individual has contributed. You know, there's another example for in British Columbia is the coal mining company. My mind just went blank. Anyways, the Keeble family's operation is called Teck Resources. Teck has operated under all kinds of different names, and they've contributed money through various different ways. And if you just go to the Elections British Columbia site and look up Teck Resources, that you will get a pretty small number. But if you know who all of the associates are, then you can soon find out that they're actually putting in millions of dollars. And then we learned through a news report that Teck Resources, for example, has failed to put up the amounts of bond money that they should have to secure and ensure that reparations are done to lands that are damaged in mining and so on, so that there is a huge, like a massive multi-million dollar shortfall of funds that have been put up. And most of the shortfall, it turned out, was from Teck. And again, this is an example of the laws enforced differently for you and I, or Joe Citizen, than it is for these big influential companies that spend a lot of money making sure that politicians are loyal to their interests. So if we could sit here all evening and discuss the different examples of similar situations, to my way of thinking, there's only one real solution to a whole set of problems, and that's to get the private funding of political parties off the table. Now, I don't have an absolute solution for that, but if we were to allocate funds from the public to each individual established political party with some method as well of assisting or giving access to people who are not yet part of the established parties, we would be better off than we are under the present system. The present system is entirely broken. Almost anything would be better than what it is today. I'm not sure that I can define what a good situation would be, but almost anything would be better.
Well, you know, that makes me think about what we had prior to the Harper administration, where federally we had the per vote subsidy, which gave a certain amount of money to every registered political party based on the number of votes they got. I think, but when it was phased out, it was $1.60 per vote across Canada. And that was a system that was used as a benchmark around the world. But in 2006, when Harper came in, the first thing they eliminated was the per vote subsidy. Because,
and of course, the reason government's willing to do that is they're the ones that are holding the Trump cards.
Yes.
And so they are the ones that have influence to sell. And so they don't need to have public funding. Per vote
yep.
funding certainly favors whoever is already established in the system. But governments can simply turn to the people who benefit from the laws or the enforcement of laws and say, we need cash, and they'll get the cash. Opposition parties cannot do that kind of thing because they don't have any influence to sell. If businesses sense that there's going to be a change of government, then they'll start to contribute. That's what happened in British Columbia in 2013. There were a few corporate donations to the NDP because a lot of people thought that the NDP would win in 2013. And as it turned out, that did not occur. And so, of course, those donations immediately stopped. I don't know if this year the corporations are hedging their bets and giving money to other parties. I somehow kind of doubt it, because I'm given to understand that the NDP is not flush with cash. So that's one of the issues that they have in terms of managing an effective opposition. But, you know, the other thing that I don't like is the idea that if you're already in the game, then we'll fund you, but nobody else can be funded, because there has to be some system of giving access to individuals that deserve access but can't afford to pay for it. And I like the old idea of free time broadcasts on radio and television. I like the idea of, I would love to see newspapers that would run editorials both for and against certain issues, you know, so that you could, the old idea, when I was young, I thought op-eds were actually stood for opposition editorials. Then I learned that in reality, op-eds stood for on the opposite page to the editorial page. So we see in Vancouver, at least with Post Media, that they'll publish whatever they want to publish as the word of Post Media on the editorials, and on the opposite page they'll publish perhaps as an op-ed something from the Fraser Institute, or, you know, somebody that just reflects exactly what they've been said. And they won't give any coverage to anybody who has some kind of opposing point of view. I know we're sort of going widely here, but I have a feeling that that's one of the reasons that people have turned their noses up at newspapers, is because they don't see it as a place for a vibrant exchange of ideas. And if that did exist, as it does exist today in social media, then I think the newspapers would be in a better situation than they are today. So
I agree with that. The corporate media echo chamber has become the way of doing business, because, you know, I mean, I don't know how many shows I've done where we get into the subject of the quote unquote public trust. It simply does not exist any longer. And my easiest rebuttal is, the news industry is dead. This is now infotainment, and everything has a value on it, and it must generate revenue or it's simply dropped. You know, that's the unfortunate part of it.
You know, I will guarantee you that the idea that $1.9 billion has gone into the hands of the gas producers of British Columbia in a year where zero revenues have been produced for the public, that won't be in the news. You know, I can demonstrate the fact of where I got what my sources are, and that it's from audited financial statements and so on, but that won't be seen as newsworthy. However, if a coyote ran through my backyard, you know, or chasing a bear, that would be headline news on some of the TV channels and so on. They'd love to go out and show you a picture of that kind of thing. So, you know, it's kind of the shaggy dog story, right? They just certain things they view as news, and other things, it's just too complicated.
Yes, the truth is complicated indeed. I think what you're referring to is commonly called the fluff piece. And
absolutely.
I believe the biggest reason that I am blocked on Twitter by Donna Friesen is because I had a propensity for grilling her on wasting airtime on a national newscast for her fluff pieces at the end of every broadcast to give everybody warm fuzzies to come back tomorrow. You're a news show. Let's hear some goddamn news.
I had a similar experience. Rob Shaw was hired by the Vancouver Sun as their Victoria correspondent. He had been working for the Times columnist. And Rob is actually a young journalist who I quite admired, whose work I quite admired. But I found fault with some of the puff pieces that he was associated with, or the failures to tell the whole story. And so I challenged a couple of things, and I quickly got blocked as well. And, you know, these people are sensitive towards criticism, but rather than looking inward and trying to examine and evaluate whether the criticism is valid, they just want to lash out. I've had lots of fun over time of repeating information. Go on my website and just do a little search for nincompoops, and you'll see that came from something that Von Palmer had said on the Bill Good Show on CKNW Chorus Radio. And he made reference to the fact that he thought the bloggers were simply nincompoops ranting in their underwear in their basements or something. And, you know, this is, first they try and ignore you, then they try and ridicule you. And,
yes.
You know, so we just have to kind of smile at that. I remember seeing a movie just a few years ago, and it related the story of where a group of gay people had decided to lend support to a miner strike in England, and they were having a conversation as to whether, trying to decide whether being called gay was appropriate or inappropriate. It was an insult, I forget the exact expression, but somebody said, what we need to do is to own the expression. So let's use it. Let's just take pride in it, right? And, of course, that's what's happened. I sort of felt the same way with Von Palmer, who has been a pundit, British pundit, for decades. When he made reference to those of us who were blogging as being nincompoops ranting in our underwear, I thought that that was something we should take pride in. So we proudly wear the tidy whitey flag of being called nincompoops. Anyways,
well, that's understandable. I mean, you know, this is the thing. I mean, there are those in the new media who fully understand the mission of the established corporate media, and it is to promote and generate revenue instead of inform and keep an eye on things. And, you know, I mean, I would just say consider the source. And that has also happened to me. You know, that's happened to me as well. I'm just, well, according to them, I'm some either Marxist or communist or dipper or this or that, because I don't reflect neoliberal rape and pillage style of governance and business model. And the one thing that I always tell people to do is watch a movie called Thank You for Smoking, which was a movie about lobbying.
Excellent.
There's one scene where the main character, whose character name was Nick Naylor, who was an outstanding lobbyist, was talking to his tween's son, and he told him the secret of debating. And the secret is, when you get asked a question that you cannot defend, you simply make it a response of taking it into the biggest realm as you possibly can, making it a black and white choice, either using patriotism or something like that, and you convey the message that the person asking the question is wrong without actually saying why or how. Then if the people listening assume that the person asking is wrong, then by default, you're right. And you haven't done anything except manipulate through language. And this is what I see happening in corporate media 24/7 now.
Yeah. To me, they end up cutting off a large segment of their audience. I may be unusual, but I really kind of enjoy an issues-related debate because I recognize that I can be mistaken in thinking. I've changed my position on issues after learning more about them, and I think there's nothing more valuable. I remember this in business, you know, where you'd make the good decisions were not just ones that came out of a bolt of lightning. There were ones that you worked collectively with other people to examine all sides of an issue and to determine what the most appropriate route forward was to be. And so I find that the whole discussion of all sides of an issue is really a good example. And it seems to me that, I can't remember who it was, but I read, might have been about the Wright brothers, where they, when the two of them doing some kind of business or engineering question, and if they didn't agree on an issue, one would argue for one side of the issue and the other would argue the other side. And then partway through their discussion, they would reverse. And so that the other brother was expected to argue exactly what his counterpart had been arguing. And so what it did was to force them to look at the issue from a different and unique fashion. And those are, I think, creative ways of examining issues, is that I hope that people don't go on my site and say, he's right 100% of the time. I hope that somebody can go there and say, hey, I think he's mistaken in this way or that way, and here's why the view is mistaken, and then to explore that and so on. Oftentimes, particularly throughout much of the old mainstream system, when they opened comment systems up, you would quickly lose focus of what the article is all about, and the issue would be hijacked by people who simply wanted to argue for the sake of an argument, for the sake of exploring an issue. And I'm fairly proud of, even though we don't have a huge amount of commenting on my site, I'm proud of the quality of it. I have, frankly, discouraged a lot of commentary that's just pointless, that's loaded with innuendo or is not civil and so on. And so I simply have had a practice over the years of not publishing things that don't add to the conversation. And so we have a group of people commenting who I think are at times brilliant in terms of their analysis and being able to add information that, even though I may have spent days or hours researching a subject, I'm still capable of learning from people who have a different point of view. And I enjoy that process. And I hope readers or listeners will kind of learn to experience that same kind of thing. Nobody in a family expects their family is going to agree on every subject all the time. And yet, when you have a discussion with somebody who's close to you and you then ultimately resolve it in a fashion that makes both of you happy, or business, similarly in business, if you have a happy customer and a happy supplier, then business goes on wonderfully well. If either one of them is unhappy, then it's not going to work over the long term. So we have to kind of open our own minds to information process. Let's have lots of room for opinion, but let's have those opinions based on fact.
Agreed. Now, to sum up what's been going on in the gas industry in BC, again, looking at your work, what we see here is an industry that employs fewer than one half of 1% of the workers in British Columbia. They are getting more high tech all the time to eliminate wasted money in exploration and extraction and production. But yet, their subsidy continues to go through the roof. an example here. In the fiscal year 2009 in BC, the government in royalties collected $1.33 billion and sold rights for a little more than $3 billion. So for fiscal year 2009, the province made almost $4.4 billion. Then we go to fiscal year 2016. The royalties to the province are $151 million. The sales of rights is $16.5 million. So in a period of 7 years, the revenue for the province has gone from $4.4 billion to $167 million.
Well, you know what, Glenn, I'll even correct that, because if you look at the fact that the amounts owed to the producers by way of these production credits we've talked about, those went up by $538 million. So you have to net that off, in my opinion, against the $167 million that was earned. So in effect, we lost more than $300 million to the gas industry on those lines of revenue. So the turnaround is not 4.4 million; it's more like 4.75 billion dollars in a single year from 2009 to 2016. Now, you would think that would be a subject that would be on the front page of the major daily newspapers, but it won't be.
You would think so, but instead, on the front page, we see another photo op for Premier Clark, pledging that the benefits of the fantastic LNG industry are just around the corner. But, you know, it's just such a detachment from the truth in the numbers that are available. It's amazing that they can do this with a straight face, in my opinion.
Well, it certainly doesn't suggest they hold the voting population of British Columbia in much respect. The LNG situation in British Columbia is, they talked before the previous election that there was going to be as much as $260 billion of government revenues over 30 years, which is almost $10 billion a year. We've just now discussed the fact that instead of $10 billion this year, we got less than nothing. And the Brown has written some really excellent articles that are published by DSmog blog. And he talks about all of the different ways that the province is beginning to increase the subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, and how this particular government has taken actions that are going to interfere with the ability to collect taxes and apply environmental rules and so on for the next 30 years or so. And if the next government comes along and says that was mistaken, or if Christy Clark is removed by her own party and replaced by somebody with knowledge and intelligence, then to change the laws and make them retroactive, we're going to be looking at paying out billions of dollars in damages to these foreign corporations. And I challenge anybody who thinks the government has had a good handle on the LNG file to go and look at what's going on in Malaysia, where Petronas is a Malaysian-owned, it's a nationalized company, and Malaysia is led by a prime minister who is proven thoroughly corrupt.
Yes.
The Americans are in the right now seizing over $1 billion of stolen proceeds, and there are investigations going on in countless different nations of the world, you know, from Singapore to Switzerland to London, to all of it relates to the people behind the Malaysian government and the prime minister there who have been a party to massive fraud against the public. Well, that's the kind of people that British Columbia's government has decided to do business with. And you have to ask yourself, why? And the old line about if you lie down with fleas, you end up with fleas yourself. If you lie down with the dogs, you end up with fleas, right? And so there's only one explanation as to why one governmental group wants to deal with people who are demonstrated in many jurisdictions to be dishonorable. And that's because the people that are making the deal, our local people, have a failure of honor themselves.
Now, not only
I can't prove it to you, but it's one that I think is a fact-based opinion.
Well, I agree. I mean, there are definitely questions of ethics and representation and loyalty. And the other side of that is what's in it for them personally in their own circle as compared to the public. Because that was a question that was asked today on Twitter before the show from Allison Creekside, another fine blogger.
Absolutely,
you know,
she is.
If the protection for the LNG producers was to be repealed, what would be the result for the BC taxpayer? And what you're saying is there would be no choice, but they would be compensated for actually having to play a clean game. Is that basically the answer?
Oh, it's, you know, it's the same as there's a dam called Site C being constructed in northern BC.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you can demonstrate through BC Hydro's own records that we have had no increase in domestic demand for a dozen years and that we're losing money on export markets. So we can demonstrate that there's been no particular need for this dam. We can also demonstrate that there's far more power saving that can be achieved through active conservation. And yet the premier made a statement not too long ago that they were doing everything they could to hurry the dam past the point of no return.
Yes.
So that they placed an order for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of generators, even though they have no need for generators for some years. You know, it was a long process to build the dam. They don't need dams this year, they don't need them next year or the year after, but they've placed an order simply because they wanted to make sure this was committed. And so that if John Horgan becomes the new premier next May, then he will be faced with a decision that says, we have already done much of the groundwork, we've already obligated to pay $5 billion or so out in costs if we terminate this project. So he's left with kind of a choice or no choice, right? It's a choice that's no choice. Why would a government try and do that? Why would they do something to cripple the actions of a future government? It's, to me, the only real answer is corruption. That we hired in that case as well. British Columbia hired companies that one was in. There was three parties to a major contract. Two had been accused of malpractice and fraudulent behavior in other countries. One was itself in financial distress that got resolved by the awarding of this huge contract. But before that, they wouldn't, you know, if things were being done squarely, this company wouldn't have even qualified to be a bidder.
Yes.
And so you see all kinds of things like that. I was visiting the Northeast in May, and Northeast BC, and I think I came away with a better and deeper understanding of what's going on there. But I also heard some stories that were really troubling about who was getting the contracts and the connections of important people to vast contracts. And, you know, these are things that don't tend to get talked about in very specific terms, because an individual like me simply doesn't have access to the reality. But when you start to hear these things being expressed by people you trust, it really is troublesome. And so I, throughout the whole aspect of my examination of government, I have high levels of concern for the honesty and efficiency at the way government conducts its business. You know, the old neoliberal idea is that we should have less government. Doesn't appeal very much to me. I would rather say that I want to have better government. To me, that's the more important thing. I don't want government to do things that are ineffective. You know, we end up with, you think back many years ago, you're probably old enough to remember the HMCS Bonaventure, you know, where they would have $200,000 toilet seat lids. And, you know, so clearly government operates best when it's forced to operate in the open with full transparency, along the lines that were promised by a certain Liberal Party back in 2001 when they were first elected. They promised the most transparent and open administration anywhere in the world. What we got was quite the opposite. And it's far worse today than it was under the early years of Gordon Campbell.
Yes.
And I still will occasionally have them pull out the 2001 platform of the Liberal Party and look at it and say, I could support a party that was interested in doing all of these things. Now, there were certain elements that they were promising that I think were fully appropriate. Turned out, though, that they just didn't believe in them. So,
They were sales points on their campaign. That's all they were.
Yep, and nobody actually believed that they had a responsibility to do them. That's perhaps a little bit unfair. I think when they first went in, they did have a view of improving government. And like many governments, as time passes and you start to forget the reason you arrived on the scene, and you start to worry about what you have to do to stay on the scene. And you know, there's so many different aspects, like BC Hydro, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point in the evening, but it used to be a company that... for all its faults, it really did a pretty spectacular job of a very difficult task. And when BC Hydro was first created, the aim was to provide service to people throughout the province, or as much as possible throughout the province, and to have the service to be effective and efficient and low cost. And unfortunately, it was one of those, it was so well done in the early years that it became the target of the sharpshooters who saw it as just a place they could go in and plunder. And boy, have they done an effective job of that.
Indeed they have. We will move on to BC Hydro and independent power producers and the hole that BC taxpayers are staring into regarding electricity generation in BC. But I want to take this opportunity, because you mentioned something there about what you'd like to see, the results, how they should be driven, what the real goal should be. We talked about this week before coming to air, and it's a problem that we've both experienced. And I imagine with the BC Liberals being the predominant neoliberal administration left in the country now that Harper is gone, I imagine there's been, well, I know just from reports, there's been quite a migration of those ilk that have gone to Victoria and British Columbia to carry on their quote-unquote work. I've been blamed many times on this show, as I alluded to, of being a lackey for this party or that party. How much do you get attacked by the BC Liberal choir for having an agenda, for being just inherently anti-BC Liberal? How much does that come across your radar?
Well, I've certainly seen it quite frequently. I spend so much time at my computer looking at many different places and sites and following. I'm fairly active on Twitter, and I don't do much in the way of Facebook, but I'm reading constantly. So that it's actually a bit of a frustration of people in my family that can't, instead of having a conversation, I tend to have a laptop on my knee, and I'm reading stuff that that I think may be helpful in writing something. But anyways, I see occasional comments about, oh, he's only an NDP shill and so on. And, I don't pay a huge amount of attention to it. It doesn't particularly bother me. But I had said on Ian Jessup's radio program that I hoped that I was taking the same kind of critical look at government. If the government changes and if he gets elected, or if the Green Party or whoever gets elected, I hope I am still taking the same kind of critical view and looking at the same financial statements and expecting transparency and openness and efficiency of government operations. It's not because I'm in favor of the NDP or the Green Party that I attack the Liberals. It's because I view what the Liberals are doing is simply wrong. And I don't spend any time to speak of looking at what the opposition parties are. And I think I said to you that if I had concerns about the actions of the cowboys that are driving a herd, I wouldn't spend my time describing what the cattle are doing. I'd be out there attacking the cowboys that are in charge of the herd. And I see that same sort of thing with respect to commentary. Somebody thinks that I should be paying attention to what members of the NDP are proposing. The time may come, but really I'm concerned with what's happening today and with the people who are making the decisions and setting the policy. So I don't accept the fact that I'm attacking the Liberals simply because I'm trying to further somebody else's interest. I'm attacking the Liberals because the Liberals deserve to be attacked and they need to alter their behavior. And if they altered their behavior, I'd have nothing to argue about. I'd have to retire, go off and write about travels in France or something like that.
Amen. Amen.
Which, by the way, my wife would be happy for me to do. She says, don't you think you're a little too negative? You're always talking about things that are wrong. And people don't want to hear that. People want to hear things that are more positive. So I'll set off to write something more positive. And I quickly get mislaid by reading something that says, wait a minute, that shouldn't be, that's wrong, or whatever. But if you look through my website, you will find a couple of lighter pieces. I think I did do a couple of pieces on a bear coming in to visit one evening and coming into our house and then returning a few days later. So I try and do a little bit of that, but it's simply my place is where you go if you want to look at political issues of British Columbia.
No, I understand that 1,000%, Norm. I know exactly where you're coming from. I mean, when I started my show, I made no secret about it. The reason I started my show is because, in my opinion, from what I could see and find and discover, the current government that we had to go. And that was my focus, because, like you said, there's only one party that matters in our electoral system, and that's the party that forms government. What everybody else does, you know, what everybody else does is merely background noise, because they have no influence.
You know, there's a subject that I would love to have the time to explore and write about, and it would be important, I think, for people in British Columbia and in Alberta, and that's to look at the experience that the Norwegians had with respect to the fossil fuel industry. When the Norwegians decided that they wanted to get a bigger share of the resource value, the multinational oil companies immediately screamed and said, it's impossible, it can't be done. If you do what you're proposing, forcing us to actually pay a fair share for the resources to the public, we're all going to leave, and your industry will be non-existent. Nobody will work, and the country will be poorer for it, and blah, blah, blah. So anyways, the Norwegians were strong enough, and smart enough to carry on and stick with that. And in British Columbia and in Alberta, we tend to ignore what the Norwegians did. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, British Columbia said, oh, we can't afford to increase royalties on gas because all of the companies will move to Alberta. And the Albertans were saying, well, we can't afford to charge more in the way of royalties because all the companies will move to BC. And so we stood there, and the oil companies smiled as the politicians stood there and said, oh, we just can't do a thing. We'll just have to let those people keep all the money. Now, if you look at what the National Wealth Fund in Norway, what they have in their equivalent of their heritage fund, it measures well over $1 trillion Canadian.
Yes.
I looked at Alberta recently, but it was under $20 billion the last time I looked. And I lived in Alberta for, back in the late 70s, early 80s, we spent a year and a half there, or as we like to remember it as two winters and one summer, which is considered two summers and one winter. The Albertans were collecting for the Heritage Trust Fund back in the 70s, I believe, and still, you know, here it is, more than 40 years later, or more than 35 years later, at least, and there's rather little left, and there's great concerns that you're going to have to continue funding those fossil fuel companies, or they won't survive. And we use all kinds of different methods of getting the funds to them. Some of them are secret, and some of them are more openly available to us, but turns out that the Export Development Corporation of Canada has spent billions of dollars on behalf of the oil companies and fossil fuel industries. And I don't think people really understand just how much, what a net cost there is to the public for running the fossil fuel industries. And in if you go over again, look in Norway, you find out that those same companies are producing product in those nations, and they're paying much more for it. And the people of Norway, I mean, Norway's not much different than the population of Alberta.
Yep.
And so if you start to look at how much on a per capita basis, how much is in the kitty of the Heritage Trust Fund, it's not very much. If you look at Norway, because they've only got a slightly larger population than the population of Alberta, that's pretty damn significant, the amount of money that they have put aside and invested on behalf for the future. And anyways, that's a subject that I would love to really seriously be able to go and examine, evaluate, and see just what the history of it is. And I have a broad understanding of it, but you know, it's perhaps not all weighted in favor of the Norwegian experiment, but I do know that it's the success of the Norwegian government in gaining revenues out of the resource, natural resources, that scares the hell out of the North American producers. And so if anybody were to actually suggest seriously that we ought to emulate the Norwegian interests, you could bet that there'd be quickly millions of dollars worth of think tanks and academics lined up to tell us what a disaster that would be. And
that would be if that concept was actually leaked into the mainstream media to begin with, because there have been those that have tried to get it to be a matter of public discourse, and it's simply buried. I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying. If you want to take a look at, say, let's use a corporate term, individual shareholder value. Now, the Alberta Heritage Savings Trust Fund has basically flatlined since Peter Lougheed left, and that was in 82. And if there are slightly over 4 million people in Alberta, and there is around $20 billion in that trust fund, you know, what are we looking at here? You know, $5,000 per person? But yet, on paper in Norway, every Norwegian citizen is a millionaire because of the system that they have established and stuck to. And as you said, Royal Dutch Shell, Exxon Mobil, Standard Oil, they're all there. They're all extracting. They're all making money, but they're not getting all the money like they do in North America.
Yep. And they would leave if that kind of regime took over or took place. But you know what? They've also spent a lot of money in the last number of years, and the neoliberal ideas have grown in Norway. They've been pushing hard to get that kind of change that has occurred in, you know, it's the old Thatcher economics, mm-hmm. or Reaganomics, and that kind of pressure is intense. I've written a little bit about the Fraser Institute fairly recently. I went through and listed out all of the 50-odd people that are serving as directors of the Fraser Institute, and they primarily represent the fossil fuel industry and the financial industry, and those mm-hmm. are two industries that depend almost entirely on government for its regulation or non-regulation. And these people that I calculated that there was over $1 trillion worth of corporate and personal wealth involved in the 50 people that sat as directors of the Fraser Institute. And they're the ones that come up with a huge sum of money, like about $20 million a year of donations that taxpayers subsidize as well, by the way. And that money gets spent on pumping out propaganda that is pushed out to newspapers all over Canada and readily published too, by the way. And,
yes.
So they bring in educators, and they try and they put these people through indoctrination sessions, and then mm-hmm. expect them to go back to their mostly private schools, and which is favored by the Fraser Institute. And then yep. they teach all these concepts to the young people that come under their influence, and you know, it's really very difficult for somebody who has a different point of view, who believes that the broad public deserves a share of the wealth of the country as opposed to a tiny percentage of people. It's these institutions like the Fraser Institute, they have their charitable status that appears to have been untouched during the Harper years, while the same Harper government was going after all of the charities that were involved in environmental works and trying to threaten them to either go quiet on matters that that were perceived to be political. And, you know, I guess anything, whether it's healthcare or environmental elements, can be thought of as political in the broadest sense of the term. But it's not necessarily a partisan. I think the rule was originally stated that charities should not get involved in partisan activities, but it's certainly information and education has to broadly fall under the political term. But I certainly don't like to see one group of individuals that are working to educate the public over the need for good environmental stewardship. They're attacked by the Canada Revenue Agency, whereas somebody like the Fraser Institute, as far as we're aware, all of the other think tanks as well. You have a couple more in Alberta, I think, and certainly lots of them in Ontario and Quebec. All of those think tanks that are pushing the neoliberal ideas, they appear to be untouched by the tax auditors. So it's the old thing that we talked about earlier. There's one set of rules for the influential and there's a set of rules for the rest of us. It's unfortunate.
Well, that's true. I mean, we've just been through a decade of Harper where an organization like Elections Canada was told they can't inform Canadians on how to vote, you know, so it's only becoming more and more highly politicized, even though the weapon they use against organizations is that they are too political. Well, perhaps they should rephrase and tell the truth and say you're just the wrong politics. If you're the right politics, there's no problem at all. And as you said about the Fraser Institute, I think something else worth mentioning is the people who intern with them turn up in the most damned places. But it's very hard to get a list of who's actually interned at the Fraser Institute. Just for an example, a lot of people will remember Danielle Smith, who was the leader of the Wild Rose Party for 5 years in Alberta. Ms. Smith, who was also kicked off the Calgary Public School Board and has been kicked out of a few other jobs relating to forming opinions and indoctrination, shall we say. Danielle Smith interned at the Fraser Institute. And you look into her later life, the type of politics she espouses, the views she espouses, it's no accident. It's definitely no accident.
You see an example in British Columbia where a person who worked with the senior level in the Fraser Institute went from there to the Vancouver Sun and became the editorial pages editor, talking about Fazal Millar. And he then left the Vancouver Sun and he went to work as an assistant deputy minister in the natural gas development ministry. And I found that absurd, and people can, again, if they look up his name in my blog, you'll find numerous examples of commentary that he's made over time. Just some of the most, in my view, outrageous kinds of concepts. And he clearly is a libertarian who doesn't believe in the government's role in society. And so isn't it deliciously ironic that he would, when job prospects came uncertain at the newspaper, he shifted over to government to work for government at a high six-figure salary. And here's this guy who didn't believe in government except every second week when a check would be dropped into his account. And so he was there as the person helping to work on these wonderful natural gas strategies that we spent the first hour talking about. now he's been shuffled off to some other segment of government to still at this sort of associate or assistant deputy minister level. And so it looks like he's found a permanent home. He's working on this guy who doesn't believe in government having a role in society, finding that it's a convenient place to earn an executive salary. So,
well, it's just like you mentioned that the mass majority of Fraser Institute directors are involved either in the financial sector or the energy sector, and yet they have nothing but opinion that government needs to leave their industries alone, but yet in reality it is government itself that is responsible and the caretakers of their monopolies.
Do you suppose if bank robbers were to form a think tank, that they would argue in favor of there being no government regulation of bank robbers? We allow people that are, this is the National Energy Board is another group that I've written about, where it's has long been a captive of the industry that it supposedly regulates. And you just look at the history of the people involved as members of the National Energy Board, and it's pretty damn clear what their role is. And, you know, I think regulators ought to be regulating, not cheerleading. So it should be the National Energy Cheerleading Board, as opposed, according to the way that they've functioned over recent years. But, you know, there are some good things, too. There's an organization called a media organization that's come up in the last year or so called the National Observer. And they've,
yes.
Mike D'Souza is the editor of that now. And he was a really excellent reporter, national reporter. There was no longer any room for him because I think his work was too good. So he's moved over and he's, the National Observer has just done some really, really wonderful work talking about the National Energy Board and its failures of regulation. And, you know, again, it really ought to make citizens of this country angry. And I don't know why it doesn't, to be honest. That we could probably spend 2 hours talking just about that subject. You know, how do you get people motivated to pay attention to some of these issues? It really is difficult. I guess you and I are trying.
Well, we are. A few shows ago, I had Sandy Garasino on, who is also an associate editor of the National Observer.
She's
and,
somebody
you know,
I quite admire. Yeah.
Yes, it was an enjoyable show. And, you know, we talked about the position they're in, being an indie, competing. I mean, the thing that really got me going was when Keith Baldry attacked the National Observer for not putting up a pay wall, but a pay fence. And it's a matter of survival for them. And here's Baldry, who is paid far more than probably the entire staff at the National Observer. And his job is to be a shill. Let's call a spade a spade. And he's laughing at them for having to take measures to continue their existence. This is a man who purports himself to be a media celebrity, but I'd like to see him given a notepad and a bus ticket and told to go get the story. He'd be absolutely clueless. You know, this is part of the hypocrisy that exists. And again, like you said, it's part of the Gandhi tenet that, you know, first they ignore you and then they make fun of you and then they fight you and then you win. You know, I mean, it's along the same lines, but that's something for another time. I think we better get down to what's really going on and what's become of BC Hydro.
Okay, Glenn, just before we leave that last subject, though, I want to repeat something that was said to me by an individual who worked in Victoria for many years and was at a senior level of government. But he said to me that, I'll quote him, here's, the Victoria Press Gallery doesn't seem interested in much these days that demands the level of diligence and research that made its deacons the stars, in quotation marks, that they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting quote that I heard, and I think he's quite correct that there's just there's a level of diligence and research to pull out stories, and I understand that it's difficult with the poor resources that newspapers and television stations, news operations, they lack for resources, but there is no excuse. My little operation operates on a few thousand dollars a year and a whole bunch of diligence, and so it's unfortunate
it can be done.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
However, I think I'm at a stage of life where I can afford to spend the time. If I were chasing a career like my own sons do, I wouldn't have time to do what I'm doing. But nevertheless, we have to hope that things will improve.
And we will continue to do our best to encourage that. But as I said, something else you mentioned earlier, when BC Hydro was established as a crown corporation in the old traditional model, it did fulfill its mandate. And it did so and turned a profit. It exceeded expectations, but it ain't like that anymore, is it?
No, it not only made profits, but it did it with efficiency. That the assets that are employed in British Columbia now to basically sell in around 50,000 gigawatts of power each year, and it's been the same for over a dozen years, but the assets employed to deliver that 50,000 gigawatts has grown by about $18 billion in the same time frame. That I'm saying that the demand has been flat. Now, of course, some of the equipment has to be updated, exchanged, and improved from year to year, but mm-hmm. we have seen an unprecedented investment in all kinds of different infrastructure related to BC Hydro. Much of it relates to running transmission lines to capture power that's being produced by private producers all over the province. I'll give you one example. There's what they call the Northwest Transmission Line, which heads up into the northwest part of the province. And when that was first discussed, it was going to be a $300-some million project. It, when finally completed in recent times, it was close to a $1 billion project. It's very difficult to build high tension lines through all of those areas of wilderness and so on. There's all kinds of impacts that creates on within watersheds and affecting First Nations rights and so on. But nevertheless, they spent close to $1 billion on that transmission facility. And the main purpose of it is to collect energy from some hydro facilities that are owned by AltaGas, mm-hmm. and then to deliver electricity to, this is Murray Edwards' business again, Red Chris Mines. So not only have we made this massive investment in acquiring power and producing power, but we've made massive investments to collect it from and distribute it to areas of the province that would be otherwise untouched except for the industrial need of the mining operations. And the entire mining industry paid less than $100 million last year in mining taxes in British Columbia. And yet, if you attach much of the value of that billion-dollar Northwest transmission line. Much of the value accrues to Red Chris Mine. Red Chris is reputed to be one of the most valuable mineral deposits anywhere. So the company that's now able to exploit it is going to do well with it. But it's been a very costly affair for the citizens of British Columbia. Now, even though we spent $1 billion getting power to Red Chris, more or less, and collecting power from Alta Gas, the mining companies, Red Chris and others, have been allowed to defer payment of all their BC Hydro bills. There was a case a while back where one of the other bloggers, Lila Yule, brought to my attention. It was a disabled woman living near Vancouver who was about to have her power disconnected because for some reason there'd been a sudden spike in the measurement of power in her place. And so there was this massive bill that the woman, because of her disability, was simply unable to pay. So BC Hydro was going to disconnect her power. It required that Lila and a number of other people in social media rallied around and ran a GoFundMe campaign and collected enough money to keep that woman's house from being disconnected. But at the same time, Red Chris Mines and numerous other mines in the province were being allowed to defer payment of their hydro bills completely because paying would cause some hardship. Now, can you imagine what the hardship is that was being caused to the billionaire owner of Red Chris Mines? Now, so they have three different mines operating in BC. There's the Mount Polly one, which was infamous for its poisoning disaster of rivers. There's another one, the Huckleberry mine, which I gather is soon to close. But all three of those are not paying their hydro bills. And that's, we haven't been given any kind of assurance that this deferral arrangement is something that isn't going to ultimately lead to a non-payment completely. We don't, you know, if these mining companies are in a state where they're, you know, unable to pay their electric bills, will we ever be paid? And they're massive users of electricity.
Oh, yes.
But the Alta Gas one that's also connected to that Northwest power line is interesting because they have some small hydro facilities in the northwest of BC producing power, and they were granted 60-year agreements, 60 years contracts with BC Hydro with price escalators, annual price escalators based on the cost of inflation. And they're being paid at more than 10 cents kilowatt hour for that power. And I'm told by somebody who worked there that it's been somewhat intermittent power because they've had technical difficulties in their facilities. And nevertheless, they're being paid handsomely for the power they do produce. If you go up to the northeast of BC, that same company, Alta Gas, is a service supplier to the gas industry, and they're a consumer of electricity, and they have the right to buy BC hydropower at commercial industrial rates, and they pay far less for the power they extract from BC Hydro, which is not intermittent power, and they pay far less, right? Alta Gas pays far less than they're being paid in their other operations by BC Hydro. So I don't know if you can imagine the situation that if I were selling, shoes out and you were buying the shoes from me and then coming around to the back door and reselling them to me at higher prices, I wouldn't be in business very long, would I?
That's true.
But that's in effect what's happening there. We have these BC Hydro committed to buying power from private power operations, and there's over 100 of them in the province now, with more coming on stream in the future. And we're paying them at very high rates. It averaged in the last quarter that BC Hydro reported almost 10 cents a kilowatt hour. whereas BC Hydro is selling power to industrial users for under 6 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's a massive subsidy to industry. Pay one thing, your marginal cost of power is more than 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and you're selling power to some users for under 6 cents, and you know that's a big subsidy that somebody's getting. And you know who funds that? It's the residential power user, because the only people that BC Hydro is seriously making money on, if you look at the average unit costs and unit selling prices, the only people providing the real money to BC Hydro are the residents. And there's also a movement afoot amongst the industrial users of British Columbia to try and get some further tax rebates based on their electricity usage, because I don't think they should have to pay taxes. And, so it's everywhere, every segment of the economy that you look at, you see where very influential people are seeking and gaining financial benefits that simply aren't available to ordinary citizens. And the ordinary citizens are ultimately going to be crushed, because those things are accelerating and getting worse. And oftentimes the impacts are not being recognized today and will have to be recognized in the future.
Well, I mean, this is not a business model. This is slow motion bankruptcy is all this is. I mean, I'm trying to think of a metaphor here, and what you're telling me is that someone in a remote location has a type of product in a known category of products. They don't always deliver. Sometimes they have problems, but you pay them a premium price for their product. Then you have to build the road to go get it. You go get it. You transport it all at your expense. And you take it to an outlet to sell. And there's no markup. In fact, there's a decrease to give it to them so they can make another product. And they don't pay you for what you just supplied them, because apparently they can't afford to, but yet they're putting high-end products out their back door.
You're sort of mixing a couple of, I probably unfairly mixed AltaGas with the mining companies. The mining companies, the ones that are deferred. With respect to AltaGas, it is a hydroelectricity producer on one part. It's a hydroelectric consumer in another part of the province, and it's paying less for the power it uses than it's being paid for the power it produces. And but they're an influential operation, and if the premier wants to hold a yoga event, or as she did a while back, then they just have to make a phone call to AltaGas and say, well, would you be happy to fund this? And the company says, sure, how much do you need? And I'm not making that up. That occurred with just yoga on the bridge, it was called. It was so absurd that it ultimately got canceled. But, it's a two-way street in the sense that business expects a return for payments it makes to government, but government likes to gain some advantages as well. So that when with the election now 9 months or so away, you're going to start see organizations being created that will be allegedly citizen operations, you know, citizens for good government, or citizens for not dealing with whatever, you know, there'll be some kind of strange organizations that pop up that are there to educate us about how wonderful the existing government is and how disastrous any alternative form of government would be.
Oh, yes, and change is bad.
Yeah. So that's the there's a quid pro quo in anything that happens in the financial world, right? You put money up on this side, you get a benefit back on that side. And that's the way it works in politics. If you're going to expect us to do a favor, then you have to do a favor for us. And it's corrupting. And it, when I was young, I was taught that Canada was a nation free of political and public corruption, but all of those other countries elsewhere in the world were guilty of it completely, and that you couldn't do business anywhere without paying some form of bribery or whatever. Well, I don't know whether it was true years ago or not, but it certainly is not true today that Canada is a nation free of public corruption. We seem to be coming to rely upon it. British Columbia has been a major customer of SNC-Lavalin, the engineering company out of Quebec that's had massive problems over recent years. They were run by a guy named Gwyn Morgan. For some time, he was chairman of the board. And Gwyn Morgan was the first large businessman to come to the side of Christy Clark when she decided to run for leader of the Liberal Party in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Gwyn Morgan is another one of these Fraser Institute characters who is readily published in the National Post and other places when he sits in his $12 million home and decides to tell the rest of the Canadians how they ought to operate.
That is true. That is true. You bring up SNC-Lavalin. That corporation is banned for, I think, 7 more years from any project anywhere in the world that has a dime of World Bank money in it. They've basically been blacklisted everywhere but Canada. And
They're not blacklisted in British Columbia.
They're not blacklisted anywhere in Canada. I mean, the massive McGill University Hospital scandal in Montreal that involved Arthur Porter, SNC-Lavalin was in that up to their earlobes. I found it very interesting that last year here in Edmonton, the largest civil infrastructure project ever, an expansion of the light rail transit across the river to the southeast portion of the city, estimated to be a $2 billion project before anything's ever done. So count on $4.5 billion. There was the base engineering contract was awarded to SNC-Lavalin. And there you go. There's an example right there. These are our boys. They're on our team. We have to make sure they survive until they outlive all their suspensions for their corruption around the world. So we'll just, here you go. Put this in your pocket. It's ridiculous for people to not see public corruption in Canada. They're simply not looking.
I agree with that. And that's part of the reason why I argue for the absolute need for transparency. I tried to find out from the Ministry of Finance what the final total was for gas royalties in the last fiscal year. I was working on the basis of a projection or a forecast that was already a number of months old. So I tried to find out what the current number was, and they wouldn't give it to me. They say, it's also the same with the provincial investment group that looks after $122 billion of pension money. I wanted to get from them a copy of the most recent inventory of investments that they hold. And they won't release it until 6 months after the fiscal year end. So the one that's out right now is more than 15 months out of date. And they simply don't want to be accountable. They claim it's because there's good business reasons that could harm their competitive situation, but that's absolute BS. They're is no reason in the world why what they held 15 months ago is threatening their financial situation. I think they really, what they don't want to do is to reveal what the truth is and where the money is. And boy, that's a can of worms that I'd love to open up. How that $122 billion gets spent and who decides where it's going to go and who's going to benefit. And, you know, I believe very strongly in the need for a good pension plan, but I also believe that the people that hold all of that money that that they collect ought to be cleaner than clean when it comes to public accountability.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Everybody remembers Nigel Wright and the circumstances that he left the prime minister's office, the whole deal with Duffy, et cetera, the 90,000. I'm waiting for the day when people realize that the reason that he was even in the PMO was the work that he did on the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. The CPP is now a hedge fund. Some of the biggest holdings the Canada Pension Plan have are in ExxonMobil, other corporations like that. I wonder how many people know that the Canada Pension Plan is, in fact, the owner of a couple models of light attack aircraft made by Textron. There's a lot of things going on that people just do not have any idea about. And this is the money that government is given to safeguard for us when we need it, when we age. And it is now being used to generate extreme wealth for those who already have it.
I looked at a list of investments held by the British Columbia Investment Management Corporation. And then I cross-referenced it to a list of 12 companies that were generally considered to be among the worst, most disreputable companies in the world. And I found that BCIMC had investments in just about all of them. It had hundreds of millions of dollars in tobacco companies. It had, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars invested in companies involved in arms supplies and war, the war industries and so on. We have this vast source of investment funds, and we don't seem to have any desire to ensure that it's employed ethically. We claim that the only thing that really counts is the rate of return. Well, and even that turns out not to be true. For example, in the past year, BC Investment Management Corporation just announced that they lost money on their investments in the last year. The Washington State Investment Board, which is a comparable operation with similar purposes, they made more than 5% or about 5% rate of return. Now, had BC Investment Management Corporation made the same returns as the Washington Group, we'd have had $5 billion more in the pension fund. Now, is that significant to an individual? In ways that they don't realize. For example, municipal pensions and other public pensions are having benefits trimmed back right now for pensions, so that if pensioners who were previously allowed to buy medical and extended health insurance through the pension system at reduced rates, they're losing that right. They're going to lose the subsidies that were applied to those extra insurance purchases. So on one hand, you have the pension fund administrators going out and saying, well, we're not sure that we can provide any kind of assistance on cost of living this year. And by the way, we have to reduce some of the other side benefits that you're getting in your pension. Well, at the same time, the management company that is looking after the funds. They have a room full of people earning more than $1 million a year.
Yes.
And yet those people are losing money. And this is something I've written about in the past. All the executives at BC Investment Management Corporation are exempt from the guidelines that the province put in place for executive salaries. And so you've seen this big push of people. Again, I make the comparison to the Washington State Investment Management Board, which only has one person earning more than $500,000 a year. And I think I haven't seen the numbers completely for this year, but the last year that I had full numbers for, I think we had more than a dozen people earning more than $1 million at the BC Investment Management Corporation. And well, the highest paid person at Washington State was a little over $500,000. I think the next person was $350,000. So it's just an amazing difference. And I cannot get any politicians in British Columbia to say there's some need for oversight by the public. And it's just another one of those hidden little crevices that people don't want to look at.
And, you know, apparently, you know, what you're going to hear from government when there's an appointment to that management board or whatever is that these people are so experienced and skilled at this sort of wealth management, but yet when they post a loss, who gets fired? Nobody.
Well, I'll tell you what, they posted a loss this year and the CEO earned $400,000 more than he did the year before. He was at 2.1 million now, and this year he went up to 2.5 million. So, but
sounds
he hasn't
like
been
a
in
good
the job
gig.
Very long. It may be, you know, because there was a change of CEOs, it may be there's an old trick in a business where when the new CEO arrives, he says, write everything off. I want to have the worst results possible. And then after he's been installed in his job and he's put his people in place the second year, he says, look at the marvelous results we've had. You know,
we've turned it around.
They blew it all out. I remember a guy, a friend of mine who worked for a company who was going through that. And he says, we've been told to find everything we can find and write it off because they want to show as big a loss as possible for the last year because they want to make the outgoing management look bad. And sure enough, 2 years later, they're all congratulating themselves on this marvelous turnaround and all being given huge bonuses. So maybe that's a play.
While they hide all their losses for a later date under their administration.
Yep.
Again, politics seeping into everything.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. However, you know, we could spend another 2 hours just talking about the real estate situation in Vancouver. And there's a piece on my blog that touched on that recently. And in that, some reading that I had done, I was just absolutely surprised to learn that we were duplicating a whole series of subpar or subprime mortgage faults that the Americans had blow up in their faces. And there was one situation that was related, talked about some questions being raised by one particular mortgage company that was placing mortgages that people simply weren't qualified to hold. And originally the claim was there was $1 billion worth of faulty mortgages. And when they finished the examination, it was closer to $2 billion. But the regulators decided they didn't want to punish these guys because that would bring insecurity to the entire marketplace. So they simply asked the people if they would please not do it again. And, you know, that's the person that I was reading said it's a little bit like being caught robbing a bank and then being told that you better leave town and don't do it again.
But
anybody
but
else
keep the money.
Go to jail.
And keep the money as well.
Oh, of course. But, you know, so it's there's lots wrong with our society, and there will be much more wrong if we don't learn to open up the information systems to have better reporting. You know, people like me should not be needed to bring issues to light. Those ought to be routinely happening when journalists who are actively searching for stories and trying to hold the feet of the powerful to account, to the fire, then they, there shouldn't have to be a blogging community. We should be writing about Japanese maple trees or, how to raise fish or something like that. But we shouldn't be writing about public issues that are of such significance. You and I have touched on subjects that reference billions of dollars of public issues. And that shouldn't be left to a couple of old gentlemen who should be sipping martinis.
I agree. But, things have become what they have become in this gilded neoliberal era that we're stuck in. If we don't do it, Norm, who the hell will? So I'll keep going. I hope you will.
I think I said to you earlier that I've got three children who between them have 9 children of their own. And I'm just hopeful that years from now, my grandchildren are going to be able to say that the old guy, old granddad, he did actually try and make this a better world.
Absolutely.
So that's my objective.
Absolutely. Well, we have hit, we're in the final 10 seconds of the live show. Anything after that will be in the archive. We have, we talked about an awful lot. We conveyed a lot of information that should be an indication to people of how deep some of this corruption and cronyism has gone. But as you said, Norm, we could go on for hours. There's always more,
Unfortunately, that's true.
But, like I said, this is basically show 2 in the BC series. And I will offer you the invitation. Anytime you're ready to come back, you just let me know, sir, and we'll do this once more.
Okay. I've enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Norm Farrell, insights.ca, insights.ca. Thank you, Norm. Have a good evening.